Uvili. This woman says she saw the Tree of Hope. Olivier's first reaction was a smile, no hint of suspicion or surprise.
I did.
He held out a hand and Kilo shook it.
That is a blessing that you have come to us and shared such a thing. Who are you, daughter of the Emperor?
She hesitated, not sure if she wanted to reveal herself in this way.
I understand, Olivier continued. We all have pasts and presence that perhaps are to be kept secret. We are united in our single purpose under the light of the God Emperor, and that is all that matters.
There was an openness about him that Kilo could not resist. She had been used to doubts and suspicion and questions, and here was a man who wore his faith like a light, accepting of her without reservation.
Kilo. My name is Euphrates Kilo.
Others nearby heard her reply, and a small pool of silence spread around them. Eyes turned towards Kilo, faces displaying a mixture of fascination and delight.
Euphrates Kilo.
It seemed impossible that Olivier's smile had widened even further.
The guide, the one that brought the light of the Emperor back to Terra.
She had accepted her role as a messenger for the Lectitio Divinitatis, but being confronted by the truth of what that meant caught her off guard.
If that is your belief. I am Euphrates Kilo, and I would like to know more about the Lightbearers.
Chapter 20. Ran fights back. Solidarity. A deeper loyalty. Lionsgate Spaceport, Stratifex Core, 6 days since assault. Hour after hour, the enemy continued to push towards the sky bridges. Pressed on all sides, it took the best part of a day for Ran to muster a force capable of pushing back against the Iron Warrior's advance. As the traitors moved further down the star sphere, they overran defense emplacements, reducing Ran's anti-air and anti-orbital fire. Cannons from lower regions were still capable of keeping back larger vessels, but a stream of dropships had reinforced the initial enemy landing. The technophage that had been introduced to the port's systems continued to plague everything from gun control to energy output, bringing rolling blackouts, environmental support shutdowns, and weapons misfires. Every tech priest was spared other duties to coordinate the response, but for the most part, Ran had access only to crude hardline communications between the Strategium and his defense posts, and short-range personal vox between companies in the battle.
Simple is best,
he told Hager and the 6 Imperial Army colonels who'd traveled to Lion Primus to receive their briefing in person. All communications equipment in the chamber had been shut off, just in case the Dark Mechanicum had devised some means of reversing the transmitters to listen in on the Council. Word of mouth was slow, but hard to intercept.
Our objective in the base is to slow the advance and contain it where possible. There's almost no leadership that I have seen, so redirect their attacks to non-vital areas. Let them rampage around the hab blocks and loot what they can. The citizens will fight to keep them at bay as well. Hager, what's your assessment of the infiltration attack in Sky City?
Problematic, said the Lieutenant Commander.
He zoomed in the monochrome briefing slate to show several key port systems that were situated close to the Iron Warrior's attack. Plasma reactors, conveyor access, and the bridges themselves are all within a few kilometers of the enemy insertion. We have no more information regarding how they arrived, so there could be further reinforcements on their way that we cannot detect.
Prioritize vulnerable sites by value and location. There are 10,000 Imperial Army veterans in Sky City. Deploy them and reinforce with 1,000 legionaries.
And what are you going to do with the rest of your warriors, Lord Seneschal?
Asked Colonel Maigrot. The Imperial Army Chief of Staff fidgeted with the brim of the officer's cap on the table in front of her.
There is another Iron Warriors column approaching along Highway 4. It is possible that a sally from one of the minor gates could assault the enemy forces from the rear, catching them before they gain access to the outer defences.
We have to deal with the enemy already here, said Ran. I'm taking 10,000 legionaries into the Star Sphere to meet the aerial assault head-on. It's the worst area in terms of our data, so I need to see for myself exactly what sort of trouble we're in.
But if we allow...
Your troopers cannot fight in the depressurized levels.
If you wish to contact Lord Dawn and request an Imperial Army Armoured Reserve be dispatched to counter the Iron Warriors, I will endorse the move. But I cannot ignore the army landed on the orbital docks.
The Colonel acquiesced with a nod of the head. She put her cap back on and stood up, straightening her uniform. The other officers also stood, looking to Maygrout for guidance.
"We will hold to the last trooper,"
she assured Ran.
"I shall send request for an armoured thrust, as you suggest. For the Emperor..."
She raised a hand to her cap in salute, copied by the other colonels. Ran banged a fist on his plastron.
"For the Emperor,"
he replied. He waited a few seconds as they filed into the Strategium, and then followed, Hager at his side.
"There is a rhino outside ready to take you to the muster, Commander. Your huskarls are already waiting for you at the transfer ramps into the Starsphere."
Hager moved quickly to one of the scanning consoles and returned with a flexi-sheet showing the top third of the spaceport. It looked like a heat map, blurs of white over a complex wireframe model.
"Latest auger returns."
"I'll study it on the way," said Rand, taking the flexi. "Remember, our mission is to slow them down. Give ground to preserve resistance. No unnecessary offensive action unless the opportunity is too good to pass up."
"Defense first. I understand, Commander."
Hager thumped a fist on his plastron, the crash of ceramite momentarily louder than the grinding of cogitators and the murmuring of servitors. Ran turned and left, knowing there were 100 things he wanted to tell Hager, and knowing equally well that they were all redundant. The Lieutenant Commander was a highly capable war leader. As he clambered through the rhino's rear hatch, Ran knew that protocol really dictated that Hager lead this attack, while he, the senior officer, continued in the role of strategic command. He was grateful that Hager hadn't even mentioned swapping places. Sun Basin, 41 days before assault. The weather rapidly worsened, so that even the days were a frigid ordeal. The further north the Adaba Free Corps trudged, the colder they felt. As altitude increased, so did the chill wind. 18 days since the train had been attacked, and the sun was a memory. Smoke choked the upper airs, spread far and wide from the continuing bombardment of the Imperial Palace. Even at midday, it was as cool as an Adaba dusk. Zenobi huddled close to the other squad members, swathed in a thick coat, the bulky gloves on her hands making it difficult to grip her lasgun and the banner pole. Despite the burden, she was grateful for the clothing, supplied by the seam stations back at Adaba. For months they had known they were destined to fight at the Imperial Palace in the heights of the Himalaya. It had not mattered when they were deployed. The turn of seasons did little to change the climate of the high mountains. Every kit bag had contained a coat, gloves, and a body stocking to be worn beneath the uniform coveralls. Though much had been lost in the wreckage, there were enough kit bags for everyone. They followed the line of the solitary rail, the locomotive and four carriages chugging along with them. The officers rode on board, but most of the available space, those four cars not adorned with cannons, was packed full of weapons, power packs, and such other supplies as could be fitted into every nook and gap. One wagon had been turned into a rolling hospital, where the 7 surviving Medicae did their best to ward off starvation, dehydration, frostbite, and exhaustion, with diminishing success. Zenobi's company had got off relatively lightly, with only a handful of walking wounded and perhaps a score of dead. Some platoons had suffered almost 50% casualties, while the companies in the middle carriages had been all but wiped out. The survivors had been spread into the existing formations, so that 2 new arrivals had joined Zenobi's platoon. One was the new squad sergeant, a gruff woman named Attar, who was as different to Alexander as the Himalaya were to the plains around Adaba. She barked her commands with a sneer, derided her squad's efforts, and was generally unpleasant. It was also clear that she was as unhappy with her assignment as her subordinates, and missed no opportunity to compare them unfavourably to her former squad. At night she muttered the names of her dead troopers, restless in her sleep. For this she was given more latitude than perhaps she was due, for nobody could imagine what it would be like to survive when everyone else around you had been killed. The integrity officers carried out hourly inspections, hovering like vultures around the marching platoons, ears and eyes alert to any mischief. The influx of relative strangers into the surviving companies stirred up suspicions, and there had been a flurry of accusations and counter-accusations. Just as they were bedding down for the night, three integrity officers approached through the dark, their pistols in hand. Jawahir arrived a few seconds later.
"Which of you is Celine Mogoe?"
she asked.
"That's me,"
Celine replied, standing up from her bedroll. There was frozen dirt on her coat, and she brushed it off self-consciously.
"What do you want?"
Zenobi knew Celine well, that no belligerence was intended, but she cringed at her friend's forthright manner in front of the Integrity High Officer.
"You submitted a message for return to Adaba this afternoon?"
"Yeah. That was to my niece. She's only 6 years old. I thought she'd like a letter from her auntie."
"Come with me."
Jawahir turned away, expecting compliance. Celine did not give it.
"What's this about?"
she demanded.
"What's the problem?"
Others in the platoon, Zenobi included, roused themselves from their sleeping sacks. The integrity officers twitched, but none of them raised a weapon. Jawahir was calmer, regarding the minor insurrection with a calculating gaze, her eyes reflecting the orange gleam of the camp burner they had clustered around for warmth.
"I wish to clarify a statement you made in your letter," said the Integrity High Officer.
"Then ask me here,"
said Celine.
"I got nothing to hide."
Jawahir looked at her for several seconds, unmoving. Her hand slowly dipped into a pocket and produced a folded piece of paper.
"Is that my letter?"
"You wrote, 'I know this battle is inevitable, that it couldn't have ended any other way, but I wish that it didn't have to be fought by us.'"
Jawahir folded the letter back along its creases and returned it to her pocket.
"Why are you reluctant to fight for Adaba? Does the future freedom of your niece mean nothing to you?"
"Come on! Celine's as loyal as any of us,"
said Tewedros from the ring of half-gloom beyond the immediate gathering of troopers.
"Which of us hasn't wished we didn't have to fight?"
There were a few murmurs of agreement, but Zenobi remained silent, watching her companions carefully. She glanced to her right, grateful to see Member sitting a few meters away. His arms were folded and his brow creased in a scowl, but he kept his lips shut too.
"Would you have others die and fight in your place? Would you trust the future of Adaba to others?"
growled Jawahir, stalking further into the light, her anger flashing as she glanced at the group of troopers.
"Nothing! Nothing less than total dedication will see us to victory! When your friend Celine has her lasgun pointing at an enemy, do you want her to wonder for a moment if she has the right to kill them? Is your life worth her hesitation?"
"I wouldn't..."
"You already have,"
snapped Jawahir.
"Selfishness breeds cowardice, Trooper Mogoe."
"What's going to happen to her?"
Zenobi asked quietly, stepping towards her squadmate.
"What's the punishment?"
"Close observation,"
Jawahir replied. She looked at Celine.
"Yours is not a grand transgression, but we must be sure of your integrity to the cause. You and others are being formed into a dedicated platoon, under the direct command of an integrity officer."
Celine laughed, her relief evident.
"That's it. Redeployment to the Naughty Girls Company. A punishment shift. I thought..."
She made a slashing motion across her throat.
"Lieutenant Okoye!"
Jawahir's voice cut across the whine of the wind, summoning the officer as if by magic, though Zenobi assumed he had already been warned regarding the arrest of Celine.
"Yes, Integrity High Officer."
"The solidarity of your platoon is admirable, but please remind them that they are not to question the authority of Integrity Officers."
"Yes, Integrity High Officer,"
growled the platoon commander. He raised his voice to address the assembled soldiers.
"You will all stand watch for the next 2 hours. Patrol by squads on the perimeter. Sergeants, take the names of any man or woman that complains."
A chorus of yes, sirs, echoed back, accompanied by a swell of suppressed sighs and grumbling.
"See you on the battle line,"
said Celine, lifting a hand to a salute that turned into a wave. She disappeared into the darkness with the integrity officers. When they were gone, Ketai slipped out of the gloom, joining Zenobian member.
"Oh, punishment, platoon," he whispered. "Do you really believe that?"
"Not a word of it," said Zenobi. "I'd be surprised if we ever see Celine again."
Zenobi slept fitfully, disturbed by the cold and a slew of disjointed dreams. She awoke as the engines of the train growled into life, fumes billowing from its stacks. Dawn tinged the horizon, and she could see the silhouettes of the sentries atop the ridge to the east. Northwards, the rising sun touched upon the snow-covered flanks of the mountains, but it was the continual shimmer of purple and blue from beyond them that caught the eye. Member rolled out of his blankets and came over, following her gaze.
"Do you think it'll still be going on when we get there?" she asked.
"I don't know if I want it to or not," he replied,
expression pensive.
"If it stops, that might mean we're too late."
"But you don't want to be walking into that storm,"
Zenobi finished for him. He nodded and looked at her.
"I'd rather we had our chance to make a difference."
Movement behind her caused both of them to turn. It was Ketai, rubbing sleep from his eyes.
"You think we will make a difference, I mean."
He crouched and started to roll up his blanket, breath steaming the air.
"Millions of soldiers, titans, legionaries, starships. You really think the Adaba Free Corps makes a difference in all of that?"
"Why not?"
replied Member, fists bawling.
"In a close battle, who knows what would swing it one way or the other?"
Ketai conceded the point with a nod and shrug, and started packing his belongings into his kit bag. Others were rousing, but the morning calls from the officers were still a few minutes away. The first they knew of the gunship was an explosion that ripped through the camp of Second Company, a few hundred meters west of where Zenobi gathered her stuff. The blast wave tossed bodies high into the air, tatters of burning bedrolls and shards of camp stoves hurled with them. The thud of the detonation rolled across the slumbering companies, a snarl of plasma jets growing louder in its wake.
"Get down!"
Ketai threw himself at Member and Zenobi, tackling both of them hard into the frozen dirt. Zenobi felt something crack in her side as his weight landed on top of her. Past his sprawling body, she saw the blunt-nosed gunship diving groundwards, cannons mounted atop the fuselage, spitting shells. She could trace the impacts through the camp, those on their feet cut down, while those still waking were tossed into the air like dolls by the barrage of explosions. The bark of the train's guns joined the noise of the attack, blossoms of shrapnel detonating around the incoming aircraft. Smaller guns on its flanks opened fire, the flare of bolts raking more death through the fleeing and huddling soldiers of Adaba.
"This way!"
said Member, as the gunship banked away, revealing a symbol Zenobi knew well, the Legion badge of the Lunar Wolves, who had taken the name Sons of Horus just before the outbreak of the war.
"Where?"
she asked, getting to her feet, Ketai and a handful of others joining them.
"Under the train,"
someone suggested.
"It'll target the train next, I bet,"
said Ketai.
"Split up!"
Lieutenant Okoye arrived with two other squads, some of them wounded. With him was an integrity officer, his uniform torn down one side, left arm a bloody mess strapped across his chest with a belt. The pitch of the gunship's engines changed, and it looped over, turning to bring its main weapons to bear again.
"Spread out!"
bellowed Okoye.
"Don't give the gunners an easy target!"
They broke like iron ants from a disrupted nest, running in all directions. Zenobi found herself heading in roughly the same direction as Ketai, the integrity officer, and three others. They headed almost directly away from the roar of the attacking gunship. She almost covered her ears, wanting to block out the increasing snarl of its approach, wincing as she expected to feel a bolt in her back at any moment. She thought about the banner, left among the packs and sleeping sacks. She slowed, thinking to go back for it. Hesitation saved her life. A rocket exploded about 20 meters in front of her. She saw an instant of brightness. Ketai lifted bodily by the blast, two others engulfed by flames. The wounded integrity officer, alongside Zenobi to her right, turned away, but she was caught looking directly at the detonation. A hot wind lifted her from her feet, carrying her several meters before she landed hard, her back catching against a jut of rock, gouging through coat and coverall into the flesh of her right side. For several seconds she thought she was deaf and blind, her world nothing more than ringing and blackness. Through the sensory static emerged other sounds, her name being called. Her vision started to fuzz back into something recognizable. The face of Ketai. Blinking hard, she pushed herself up, feeling pain slash through the side of her face as the skin stretched. She lifted a hand, and blood came away on the fingertips of her glove.
"Just a gash," said Ketai.
"You live."
Part of his left ear was missing, crimson dribbling down the side of his neck. There was a burn mark on his coat near the left shoulder, too.
"Look here!"
One of the third squad troopers was standing over something a few meters away. He had his lasgun in his hands, pointing down at the integrity officer, who lay crumpled and unconscious at the man's feet. Zenobi's eye caught a glint of metal in the light of the flames from the rocket. She stooped and pulled the wounded officer's pistol from the melting frost.
"This is the one that took Celine,"
the trooper said, his finger moving from the lasgun guard to the trigger.
"Nobody's going to miss this bastard."
"What?"
Zenobi took a step.
"What are you doing?"
"I'm done with this,"
the trooper said. Zenobi remembered his name was Tewedros.
"Those integrity officers will kill more of us than the enemy."
Zenobi was aware of the weight of the pistol in her hand. She lifted it, aiming at Tewedros's right eye.
"Put down your lasgun," she said.
"Why? You're not going to choose me over him. What have they ever done for you, huh? This type would have been grinding you about slacking on the line. Bullies, nothing more."
"There's too much at stake to fight among ourselves," said Zenobi. "Did you hear what happened about the Voxcaster?"
"So what? So what if someone tried—"
"It's all or nothing. You're either for the cause, or you're the enemy. Jawa here is right. They're all right. Look at you, thinking to kill your own."
"They're not our own. This one wouldn't give your body a second look. You don't know anything. Barely old enough to work the line. We don't need them to know what we're fighting for."
"I've worked the line," said Zenobi. "And my family worked it. I worked since Horus started this war, so don't tell me I don't know what we're fighting for. It's not so we can turn on each other. This is our chance to fight for our future."
She saw the look in his eyes, the tightening of the skin as he grimaced, and knew he was going to pull the trigger. She pulled hers first. The lasbolt hit him in the cheek, searing through flesh and bone in an instant. He fell, folding in on himself like a worker exoskeleton suddenly powered down. Her hand started to shake, until she felt strong fingers closing around her own, another hand gently lifting away the pistol. She turned her head numb and looked at Ketai.
"You are first one," he said.
"First what?"
"First kill."
She looked at Tewedros's body, a trickle of blood leaking from the neat hole in his face. The moisture in his eyes was already glistening with ice.
"Didn't think it would be one of our own,"
she said quietly, lowering her hand.
"It wasn't,"
Ketai told her. She couldn't take her eyes off Tewedros. Who knew the enemy would look so much like her friends and family? Chapter 21 Give No Ground. A tense ascent. The long walk. Lionsgate Spaceport. Mass Effect's skin zone. 6 days since assault. As though it were the Fist of Dawn himself, Rand's counterattack punched deep into the oncoming companies of Iron Warriors. Hall by hall, conveyor by conveyor, they drove back into the Star Spear, while assault companies bounded from level to level, scaling the skin of the spaceport to fall upon the enemy from without. While they waged a fresh offensive into the Star Spear, the Imperial Army surged from Sky City into Low District. Ran led from the front. The deployment of the first assault cadre on open ground had been something of an oddity, although highly effective. Their specialist equipment and tactics were intended for warship-to-warship boarding and defence, as well as combat in close urban environments. The confines of the Lionsgate spaceport were perfect ground, with broad areas linked by narrow choke points he could easily defend, or tight channels and passages along which his troops could advance with near impunity behind their boarding shields. In their wake, several thousand more Space Marines consolidated their hold on the reclaimed territories, guarding against counterattack and flanking forces. Siegecraft was no mystery to the 4th Legion traitors. Their specialist wall breakers and assault companies had been landed en masse across the Star Spear. Having swept away the remnants of the Standing Defence Force, whose efforts had been much hampered by the lack of environmental protection, the Iron Warriors had secured several wide bridgeheads around the highest landing decks of Sky City, and were bringing in squads by the dozen to reinforce any contested position. In a few more hours, they would be able to meet up with the enemy force at large in the Sky City Core, undercutting almost half of the Imperial Fist's offensive. Ran was determined to retake at least one of the docks, cutting off the reinforcements at source and giving the Iron Warriors cause to think twice before sending another wave directly into Sky City. From across the nearby commands, he pulled together the breach companies of the assault carder. A steady slew of transports moving along the inner ringway brought in many, others arriving on foot from closer postings.
"It's just a matter of time before they have so many troops we can't hold them back,"
Ran explained to Sergeant Autor.
"Attack is the best form of defence, Lord."
The veteran laughed.
"Well, nothing to do with you not wanting to be sitting in the Strategium looking at screens rather than running about with an axe in your hand."
"I resent that implication," the commander replied with a grin. The 400-strong assault carder gathered 10 levels below the extent of the Iron Warrior's furthest advance. Pockets of Space Marines from the 4th Legion had established themselves across the upper tier, but seemed reluctant to advance into Sky City, as though waiting for something, despite the advantage gained by their rapid and unexpected advance.
"They should have pushed on for the bridges," Ran continued, marching at a steady pace with his warriors.
300 of them made their way to the great loading conveyors in the skin of the Star Spear, while 100-strong force under Lieutenant Corner had been sent ahead to make a long climb by stairwell. Corner's force would arrive a few minutes before the main attack, sowing some discord among the Iron Warriors, who undoubtedly had strong cordons across the rapid transit shafts and docking elevators. Hagar's periodic updates painted a grim picture. The technophagic invasion continued to intermittently play havoc with the scanners, Vox network, and transportation systems. Even with the assumption that many of the Augur readings were false positives, acting as a mask for the true location of the enemy, there were several thousand Iron Warriors in the Star Spear, while 10 times that number were reinforcing the attack at the base. It was unimaginative, a simple pincer assault on the vertical rather than horizontal, but the traitors did not need to be sophisticated. They had orbital supremacy and the advantage of numbers. Ran was only thankful that it seemed the World Eaters and Emperor's Children were reluctant to join the attack in force without their warp-twisted Primarchs. If the psychic shield failed and the Neverborn appeared, as they had during the latter stages of the Void War, there was likely nothing short of the Emperor himself that could hold the spaceport.
"It's time,"
he told his companions, signalling Sergeant Autor towards the control panel between the two massive conveyor gates. Autor plugged in the device supplied by Magos de Verilax, which contained a cipher devised by the Magos to override any lingering technophage. It could only be introduced to systems locally and physically at the moment, but Hager had assured Ran in the last update that a more widespread cure was being created.
"I hope this works," said Autor,
pushing the call buttons. The clamour of arriving troops echoed around the loading bay.
"What's the worst that could happen?"
joked one of the assault veterans.
"This doesn't work, and the enemy override the emergency protocols so that we get dropped 10 kilometres straight to the bottom of the shaft,"
the sergeant replied gruffly, his usual humour stifled by the tension that was building among the legionaries.
"And this will also mask our arrival,"
Ran broadcast, seeking to find something more reassuring for his warriors to think about.
"Unless someone's stood looking down the shaft, they'll have about 30 seconds warning before we arrive. We're treating this as a bridgehead engagement, even though technically we're defending,"
said Autor, reiterating the briefing Ran had given them all half an hour earlier.
"We break through the first defence line and set up for hit-and-run raids across the neighbouring grid zones. We're the shield for the companies that are following. 10,000 of our brothers are ready to counterattack, but they'll get nowhere if we don't keep the enemy off the transit ways and conveyor shafts."
"Deployment is critical," Ran told them over the Vox.
"The conveyors are large enough to carry the whole force between them. But if we get stuck on the exit, we can't bring numbers to bear. Lead squads will take hits, but we need a 50-meter zone of control within 10 seconds of arrival. Use your shields.
Advance under cover fire. You've done this 1,000 times. He almost said, it's just another battle, but chose not to at the last moment. This wasn't just another battle. His warriors knew it, and would see such a speech for the platitude it was. Rand took a different approach.
We're going to be in the battle of our lives in about 3 minutes. Lord Dorne and the Emperor are depending on us to hold this spaceport for as long as possible. No pointless heroics. We fight for as long as we can, and make them pay for every pace they take on our world. They advance 10 meters, we'll drive them back 5. You look after your squad brothers. Keep tight, and trust in one another.
He took a breath, and in the pause heard the rattle of the approaching conveyors.
This is why we are here. This is what we were created for.
With a squeal of metal and crunch of braking gears sliding into place, the 2 massive platforms arrived. The command overrides, keeping their approach secret, had shut down the motors for the doors, meaning they had to be manually cranked apart. 4 legionaries apiece started on the lock wheels that flanked the gateways, like sailors of old on a capstan. Nearly 30 meters high, 1 meter thick, each sliding gate weighed several 100 tons. Step by step, boosted by their armour, the legionaries worked the wheels, the doors creaking apart 1 few centimeters at a time. When the gap was wide enough for a space marine to pass through, the squad started to board, pushing on into the cavernous interiors, boots echoing as though in some grand hall.
These are just the small service shafts, Rand remarked to Autor. You can fit tanks or nightwalkers in here, but it's the mega conveyors in the core that we really need to hold. They're the Titan lifters. Can we disable them, Lord? And Lord Dorne has made it clear that the facilities for a strong counterattack must be maintained.
The doors were about 10 meters apart, and Rand joined the cluster of warriors pressing through the gap, shield on one arm, axe in the other hand. His bolter and second axe were clamped to the inside of his boarding shield, which was as big as a tank hatch. Autor joined him, the Magos's electronic key box in hand.
We're going to use the door motors at the top, aren't we?
The sergeant asked.
Yes, sergeant, we are.
When the last of the assault force were aboard, the door gears were disengaged, and counterweights rattled past the conveyor, pulling the gate shut. The crash of the closing portals shuddered through the immense cage, echoing up the shaft.
Just another bang,
Ran assured his warriors.
There's about 10 megatons of ordnance hitting the port every second. Nobody's going to care about one more bang.
The floor vibrated as the conveyor motors kicked in, juddering at first as the weight was taken up by immense chains and gears, becoming smoother as the mechanism found its pace. Rand ignored the urge to look up. He knew there was no ceiling, just empty shaft above where chains swung and clanked. Instead, he turned and focused on the doors. The rest of the company followed suit, an about turn that had them all facing the way out when they arrived. Lead squads jostled past those assigned support duties, bringing their shields to the fore, while others readied their bolters. A few had more exotic weapons, flamers, graviton guns, plasma guns. Mentally counting off the levels as they passed, Rand calculated that they were 40 seconds from arrival. In 10 seconds, the noise of the conveyor would be too loud to miss. 30 seconds ago, the stairwell force should have begun the attack. Everything had to be timed. The technophage interruptions to the vox meant anything but almost line-of-sight communication was likely to fail, or worse, be intercepted.
15 seconds,
he called out to his troops. Autor connected the key box to the rune pad, and the lead squads advanced several more strides, almost to the gates themselves. Shields crashed together, forming a wall inside the conveyor.
10 seconds!
Every warrior had a visor chronometer, but there was nothing like an insistent voice in the ear to concentrate the mind. Rand took a moment to push power through the auto-senses of his armour, blanking his vision whilst boosting the aural signal. Through the mess of machinery and detonations, he thought he could pick out bolter fire nearby. If he was right, it meant the vanguard had arrived just at the right time.
5, 4, 3, 2, 1.
There was a pause,
Two more seconds before the conveyor thudded to a halt, dipping ever so lightly so that the whole company tilted. Armor whined, compensating for the motion.
Doors!
Autor activated the connection, and the great portal groaned open, revealing an expansive chamber as large as the one they had left, lit by strip lumens and the flare of bolt shells. A waft of lubricant, bolt propellant, and stale sweat flowed past Ran. Rounds started clanging against the doors and zinging into the conveyor. Detonations sparked along the front line of legionary shields. Beyond them, Ran could see the metal armor and yellow and white stripes of Iron Warriors squads. Many of them turned to face a blur of yellow emerging from a distant stairway. Others had kept their weapons trained on the conveyors. Ran couldn't fault the enemy fire discipline.
"Advance!"
he bellowed, lifting his axe. The conveyor filled with thunder as 150 legionaries pounded out through the doors, soon joined by the clamor of bolters and the snap of plasma. A roar emanated in unison from 400 external address grills.
"For Dawn and the Emperor!"
Varanzi approaches, 35 days before assault. It was hard to remember if this was the fifth or sixth day since the blizzard had begun. At least it spared them any more strafing runs from passing aircraft. The integrity officers had given up trying to marshal everybody into a single column. There were simply too many stragglers, and they were losing their own in sudden flurries of snow or down unseen crevasses. They'd been forced to leave the locomotive behind 3 days earlier. The track had simply stopped, running into a blasted plasma crater that shone like glass. It was impossible to know whether the hit had been deliberate or simply collateral damage from the ongoing bombardment of the Imperial Palace. Now and then Zenobi thought she could see the towers among the half-seen mountain peaks, but Member assured her it was impossible. "Just more mountains," he said. The aurora of the defence screens still danced beyond the horizon, tinging the snowstorms with a blue and purple aura, flickered with the gold and silver of orbital attack. The rumble was constant, broken every few minutes by the higher-pitched whine of some other kind of projectile, or the drawn-out, excoriating snarl of a plasma detonation. That they could hear anything over the strengthening winds was testament to the fury of the attack. The cold reminded Zenobi of the first time she had been taken to the upper levels of Adaba by her aunties. The Hive was nothing like the towering spires of some other cities. Most of it spread 160 kilometres outwards in the cradle spurs across the plains. Even so, its highest point was several kilometres above sea level, the air bitter. She'd cried, only 7 years old, her face stinging, gloveless hands bitten to the bone by the chill. She had wondered why her aunties had taken her there, but had been too upset to ask, thinking it was perhaps a punishment. She'd certainly appreciated the view, such as it was from freezing, scrunched eyes, and she'd been very fond of the heat of the forge line when she'd returned, reminding her that she belonged there. Now she realized they'd just been showing her something different. They'd said nothing, faces wrapped in oil-stained rags or scarves, but she remembered now their look as they gazed far across the wastes of Afrika. It was a lesson that not everywhere was the same. Zenobi looked back and thought how different, how much bigger her world was now. They tried to show her a glimpse of what could be, of the lands beyond the walls of her home. Back then there might have been a chance she'd leave Adaba, either by herself or on a caravan, maybe meet someone she loved and travel to their home. That had ended with the war. Nobody was allowed off the line without good reason. Dawn, and through him the Emperor, had needed Adaba to labour hard and unceasingly. Dreams of distant cities and strange shores forgotten. She almost stumbled over something at her feet. Zenobi thought it was a rock at first, dark beneath a thin layer of snow. Ketai stopped and pushed it with a foot, revealing it to be a coat-swathed corpse. It wasn't someone from Adaba. The skin was far too pale, the hair straight and brown, not curled and black. He wore a blue uniform, a long dress coat of black with silver braiding hiding most of it.
"Guess we're not the only ones that came this way,"
said Member, teeth chattering. His face was almost hidden between collar, improvised scarf, and hood. He folded his hands under his armpits and stamped his feet. Zenobi planted the banner pole in the snow and crouched beside the body. She reached out a hand covered with three layers of glove, the two larger pairs salvaged from companions that had succumbed to the elements. There was something on the man's chest, almost hidden by ice.
"Cut open,"
she said, pointing to a horrendous wound that ran from shoulder to gut. The injury was a wide, ragged cut that had splayed his ribs and chewed through internal organs.
"What could do that?"
"Keep moving,"
Okoye told them, emerging from the snow, his right side clad in white from the wind-blown ice.
"If you stop, you might not start again."
Nobody had strength enough to protest. Zenobi retrieved the banner and plodded on, following in the larger footprints made by Menba, her shorter legs making harder work of the snowdrifts. They found other mounds in the snow, more corpses. All of them were dressed as Imperial Army conscripts. Advancing with lasguns at the ready, about half a kilometre later they came upon the broken wreckage of tanks and transports, 30 in all. The vehicles had tried to form a circle, but were heavily damaged, some of them with their roofs blown out, others with shattered track guards, links scattered beneath the snow, waiting to trip the unwary. There were hundreds of bodies, most of them still inside. Everything was frozen solid like a pictograph. General Captain Egwu had stopped amid the carnage, and was in conference with Jawahir and several others. Zenobi caught snippets of their conversation through the wind as she and the others trudged past.
"Moved on by now. So many bolt impacts it had to be the War Master's legionaries," Egwu said. "We haven't any choice but to push on. There's a road about 40 kilometers further along. We'll follow that towards the palace proper."
"And if we get attacked, Captain?"
countered one of the attending lieutenants.
"We'll fight, of course," answered Jawahir. "We're not here to martyr ourselves. The Adaba Free Corps will fight for its people, in whatever way it has to."
Hers was the final say, and the cabal of officers moved to continue on their way.
"You!"
Egwu called out through the blizzard. Zenobi stopped and looked around, trying to see who she was shouting for. The general captain pointed directly at her and turned, forging through the snow.
"Trooper Adedeji!"
Egwu's face was burnt down one side, the scar tissue twisting strangely as she grinned.
"Zenobi, isn't it?"
She nodded her reply, not sure what to say. Jawahir loomed out of the snow beside the general captain, brow furrowed.
"What's this?"
Egwu asked, pointing to the pole across Zenobi's shoulders.
"You're still carrying the banner?" "Of course, banner, madam. I'd never leave this behind."
"See,"
said Egwu, rounding on her officers, proving some point that Zenobi was not aware of.
"Trooper Adedeji has carried the company standard for 230 kilometers already. Nothing's going to stop her getting to the battle."
Zenobi saw an opportunity to ask a question that had been nagging at her and her companions for several days. There were quite a few of them nearby, having stopped to witness the conversation.
"How much further, banner madam? How long until we reach the Imperial Palace?"
Jawahir replied first, waving a hand to the north. There were frozen droplets on her eyelashes, her cheeks even more sunken than before.
"Are you sure that's where you want to go, Adedeji?"
she asked.
"The wrath of Horus falls with 1,000 shells an hour. The Emperor's Aegis weakens by the day. You know it is only a matter of time before it fails, and the palace will break under the War Master's anger."
"Where else would we fight?"
said Zenobi. She turned her gaze back to the general captain.
"How far is it?"
Egwu glanced away, and for a moment Zenobi thought she was not going to answer. Then she looked back at the trooper, her expression intent.
"Nearly 1,000 kilometers, Zenobi. Over mountains and valleys, higher and higher. The air thinner and thinner, as winter grows colder."
"Thank you."
Zenobi shifted the weight of the company's standard and turned to the other troopers. She met the gaze of a few, Member included. Some looked worried, confronting the challenge ahead. Others matched her look of determination. She said nothing else but started walking, concentrating on putting one foot in front of the next for as long as she needed to. Chapter 22 Attrition. Iron Within. Amon and the Neverborn. Lionsgate Spaceport, Stratofex Core, 6 days since assault. The darkness was split by the flare of bolts snarling back and forth across the lading hall. The vast space echoed with the discharge of weapons and the crack of impacts, cut through with the hiss of plasma bolts and high-pitched whine of melter weapons. Every flash threw stark light onto the rows of iron warriors that held the upper gantries and walkways, and across a black void a solid barrier of shields emblazoned with the device of the Imperial Fists. Half-seen chains and lifting rigs lurked in the shadows. The floor and mezzanines scattered with the broken remains of the Fourth Legion's last attempt to cross the open ground. That assault had been 10 hours earlier. Since then, Forex's Iron Warriors had been caught in an ever-tightening noose of Imperial Fists and Imperial Army auxiliaries. The latter were a lesser threat. The confines of the chambers and passages around the reactor relays, a poor environment for massed platoons. Unable to make their numbers count against their far superior opponents, the Emperor's soldiers were being used to slow down breakout attempts, selling their lies for just long enough to allow the Imperial Fists to bring more potent opposition to bear. It was a callous tactic, and Forex found himself admiring the commander that employed it, whoever that was. Perhaps Sigismund, the famed first captain, though there had been no report of Dawn's Blade in any of the encounters so far. It might have even been the hand of Dawn himself that pulled the defender's strings. It didn't matter. Forex had only two concerns as he stood on the line with his warriors, firing his bolter down at the shield-bearers below. Concerns he voiced when Captain Garal voxed a request to withdraw several squads to the rearguard.
"If we weaken here, the Imperial Fists will push us into the anterior channels. They will be able to set up a secure picket across 5 levels of the transfer station, blocking all access to the reactor conduits. If we continue to engage at this intensity, Triarch, we will run into logistical issues within 7 hours. Better to withdraw and temper the level of battle and fight for longer. The lead companies of the aerial assault force are only 2 kilometers away."
"Logistical issues? You mean ammunition supply?"
"Stimulant infusions are reaching unsafe levels. Armor recycling systems need flushing before they start passing toxic elements back into our bodies. Nobody has slept. At the 96-hour mark, mental fatigue starts to accelerate rapidly."
"You want a rest?"
Forex poured all of his scorn into those words, then regretted the rebuke immediately. Garal was leading the upper elements of the force 0.5 kilometer away. If he chose to make a breakout, not an unreasonable strategy, he would leave Forex utterly bereft of support. He assumed a more accommodating tone.
"Your attention to the longer-term viability of our force is commendable. And yet, survival is only one of our 2 objectives, Captain."
"What do you mean, Triarch?"
A lascannon pulse burned through the wall just above Forex's head, showering droplets of molten plasteel onto his armour. He shifted to his left, allowing Merrig and his Reaper autocannon to take position and return fire. The pound of the twin-barreled weapon shook the walkway for several seconds until the gunner stepped back, lifting his smoking weapon.
"Enemy heaven weapon eliminated, Triarch,"
he said with a hint of pleasure. Forex banged a fist against the warrior's shoulder guard, a mark of praise, and then pointed for him to move further along the walkway to find another target worth expending his precious ammunition upon.
"What was I saying? Survival. I don't plan to simply be the bone these dogs of Dawn chew on while Kroger takes the bridges above. I aim to live long enough to see them all dead. To do that, odd as it seems, we have to make ourselves as much trouble as possible. We're not getting out of here alive by ourselves, Garal. We need that relief column."
"It's no good to us if we're all dead when it arrives," said the captain, voice strained.
"The wave attacks through the lower levels ran out of momentum 6 hours ago. 30,000 of the Fourth that followed the lesser formations are engaged in brutal back and forth with Dawn's Sons. Most of them are new recruits, barely worth the armor they wear. They're not coming. That leaves just the suborbital attack force. If they're going to reach us, we need to draw away as much opposition as possible. We have to remain a mobile and relevant threat."
"I understand, Triarch. If I relocate westwards by 300 meters, There is a maintenance conveyor shaft. We'll be abandoning the upper perimeter, but we can flank the defence of the plasma conduits.
So commanded, Forex said without hesitation. I will pull back a company on my left as a feint, to draw more enemy inwards towards the central force. That will give you time to break off engagement and move.
Affirmative. We'll commence manoeuvre in 10 minutes.
The vox crackled into inactivity, replaced by the cacophony of the battle that raged around Forex. Once he'd ordered Lieutenant Sapara to pull back on the flank, his mind's eye shifted from the wider area to his immediate locale. The warriors of the 4th Legion needed to get across the open ground between the conjunctions of stairwells and walkways, but the Imperial Fists were content to defend the opposite side of the hall, ready to cut down anything that ventured out from cover.
"Lieutenant Drake, have your iron havocs ready," he voxed. "Assemble on me for dedicated strike force. All other legionaries maintain fire discipline."
He mustered together 8 squads from his surroundings, moving them down several levels towards the floor of the lading hall, while squads of iron havocs with las cannons, plasma cannons, multi-melters, auto-cannons and other support weaponry made their way to him from across the force. At the 10-minute mark, as Sapara and Garal would both be making their moves, Forex ordered the attack. Targeting a narrow front of the Imperial Fists line, about 100 meters wide and 5 stories high, the ad hoc Iron Havoc's company unleashed a torrent of shells, las bolts and plasma, while Forex's squads burst down the remaining steps and loading ramps.
"Hold bolt of fire!"
he bellowed at his warriors. The fusillade above masked their energy signature, and he didn't want anyone to give away their position in the darkness.
"Wait for my command!"
Plasma bolts smashed into shields and armour, slashing through both, while salvos of Reaper rounds and heavy bolter fire tore into the gaps carved by lascannon hits. Pounding across the ferrocrete floor, splashing through puddles of blood and oil, Forex panted hard, hearts and lungs pushed to capacity. The first sparks of bolter fire sliced down into his force, passing over him into the squads behind. There were several shouts from injured legionaries.
"Keep moving!"
Forex ordered, straining even harder, his armour carrying him forward in 3-metre strides. The heavy weapons flared hard for several more seconds, punishing those foes that had remained in the arc of fire. By light of las cannon bursts and detonating bolter rounds, Forex saw yellow-armoured legionaries ripped apart, their plates no match for the power of the weapons levelled against them. Through the flare of the Iron Warrior's heavy weapons poured more bolter fire from the Imperial Fists above, but not directly ahead. The brief but massed fire of the heavy weapons had done its job, carving a narrow but telling wound into the defence line. Forex and the lead squads gained the stairwells opposite unhindered, crashing over the bodies of Dawn's sons.
"Split by combat squad and provide cover to gather weapons and ammunition," Forex ordered.
Half of his warriors set upon the corpses of the Imperial Fists, ripping free bolters and magazines, tearing boarding shields and blades from their dead hands. The others pushed outwards as more squads piled into the breach, securing the level above.
"Lieutenant Uhaz, what are the enemy doing?"
he voxed.
"Pulling back, Triarch."
"Not mustering for counterattack."
"No, Triarch. They are moving away from your position."
"Good. Cover fire and advance by company."
"Affirmative, Triarch."
Forex turned back to the open hall, almost tripping over the body of an Imperial Fists legionary. He looked down. The warrior's helm had been cracked open by an autocannon hit. Moving his gaze back to the hall, he counted his dead. 13 more. Not a bad price to pay for getting across the hall, but he'd expended a good amount of heavy weapons ammunition and power cells to do it. All to get 200 meters closer to an objective he wasn't even trying to destroy. Exultant Wall Zone, 8 days since assault. Amon was known for his patience, even among the custodians, but he had not expected his investigations to be quite so lacking in progress. Gatherings of the Lectitio Divinitatis were scattered all across the palace, and far beyond, he suspected. Yet he had seen nothing more threatening than glorified debating groups and book discussion. Whatever power the officers in the quarantine barracks had tapped into was so far absent elsewhere. Keela's information about the Lightbearers was the only solid lead they had, but Amon shared her opinion that such progress would be wasted if he made his involvement known. Consequently, the custodian had agreed to allow her to return at the next gathering to see if there was a repeat of her previous experience. She had claimed it might have been her own unique connection to the Emperor that had brought about the vision, although Amon was inclined to believe it was more a case of shared mass hallucination. Even without artificial induction, such shared manias were possible, and under the constant stress of the siege, all kinds of psychological phenomena were bound to surface among the stifled populace. Pessimism was no excuse for lack of thoroughness, and Amon was determined to continue to observe as many of the remaining sects as possible, in case the light-bearers proved to be a false hope. His current self-assigned target was a gathering of Imperial Army recruits taking place in one of the makeshift Medicaid sprawls that had been set up a few kilometres from the fighting at the Exultant Wall, where many casualties were arriving from the offensive through the Lionsgate spaceport. His presence would be considered exceptional, if not threatening, and so he went clad in nondescript cloak and robes. If anyone paid him attention, it was likely they would take him for a warrior of the Legionis Astartes, rather than a custodian. He expected no trouble, but carried a gladius-style blade, favoured by the imperial fists concealed within his garb. He caught the smell of blood and rot, even before he came to the outskirts of the Medicaid encampment. Though ostensibly a field hospital, there was little more here than in the other slums, the only exception being that the inhabitants were wholly of the Imperial Army, rather than from the dwindling, non-combatant populace of the palace. The hospital stretched for 3 kilometres, and over several stories of former administratum hab-blocks, the cells and dorms well-suited to wards and quarantine rooms. Infants carried ration packs and water flasks, while older children acted as stretcher-bearers, a constant stream of wounded coming in from the front lines. The grisly task of disposing of those that did not survive fell to them also, in almost equal numbers, bodies carried to funeral pyres in an old power plant building a few hundred metres west of the facility. The furnaces burned as constantly as they had done before the siege, but now with a far more grotesque fuel. Flies swarmed thick, drawn by gangrene. Every effort had been made to provide sanitation, but the stench of urine and feces could not be masked. As Amon picked his way through the lines of miserable wretches, he encountered no few that were dead in their cots, their fluids seeping into the bedding. The more he observed the dismal scene, the greater his misgivings. Having witnessed the horrors of the quarantine zone and the proximity of the first apparition to that degradation, it occurred to Amon that this great hoarding of the dead and dying might be some other part of the Death Guard's plague scheme. It took only a few minutes to locate the shrine that had been erected. The surrounding chambers were empty of patients, which made it instantly stand out among several city blocks of virtually wall-to-wall casualties. In what had once been a ranking clerk's offices, the wooden aquila that had served as a backdrop to the administrator's duties had been brought forth onto an altar of ammunition crates, draped with service medals and identity tags. Lazpacks and bullets were placed at the foot of the altar, ankle-deep, as offerings to a far more belligerent form of deity than the one worshipped by the light-bearers. Watching the 100 or so wounded troopers, Amon observed the usual ritual forms, incantations, marching songs instead of hymns, and finally a shared moment of silence. The soldiers were instructed by their leader, a nondescript woman in the uniform of a corporal, the side of her head wrapped in bloodied bandage, to turn their thoughts to those still fighting, to ask the Emperor to lend them strength in the ongoing battle. Amon was about to depart, seeing nothing amiss, when he caught a sweet-smelling breeze. The troopers were talking in unison, the words barely audible but clearly intoned.
"He is the life within death, the breath on your lips, the hope in your heart."
A ghost light played about the aquila on the makeshift table, like dappled sunlight reflected from water. A breeze stirred the pile of offered munitions, so that casings clinked against each other, settling into the pile. The chanting grew louder, the same words over and over.
He is the life within death, the breath on your lips, the hope in your heart.
The troopers, heads bowed, swayed to the tempo of their invocation, the corporal priest standing before them with eyes closed, hands clasped to her chest. A line of glistening drool fell from the corner of her lip and dripped to her filthy shirt. That was not all. Her eyes moved back and forth rapidly beneath their lids, like one in the throes of deep sleep. The veins in the back of her hand grew darker, as though black fluid ran through them. Amon's fingers closed around the hilt of the gladius as he moved from beneath the shadow of a broken stair, boots crunching grit underfoot. The woman's eyes snapped open, orbs of pure black, glistening with a sheen of mucus that dribbled down her cheeks. She turned towards Amon as he broke into a run, a screech rousing the 100-strong congregation from their reverie. Opening their eyes, they cried out in disgust and alarm, even as the corporal threw a hand towards Amon, another shriek of command issuing from cracked lips. A few responded, pulling at combat daggers and pistols, leaping forward to intercept the accelerating custodian. They fell, gutted or headless, not even interrupting his stride. The neverborn creature hissed and pounced like a hunting cat, fingernails that had become claws lancing towards Amon's face. He swerved and brought up the short sword, stabbing through the creature's chest as it passed, cutting from breastbone to pelvis. Almost bisected, the remains flopped to the dusty floor, where the monstrosity continued to flap and flail through a trail of filth and blood, turning back towards Amon. The rest of the gathering erupted into mayhem, some trying to flee, running into others immobile with terror, or stepping forward to aid the custodian. He stepped around a lunging hand and brought the sword down hard, tip-piercing skull and ferrocrete. He ripped it out and struck off the head to be sure. Even then the body quivered for several more seconds, claws raking at the dirt. When it finally flopped sideways, Amon saw that the clawing hand had not been random, but had etched a diabolic symbol into the floor, the shallow inscription filling with bodily fluid. Amon was at a loss as to what to do next. Several of the congregation had already fled. Others were starting to run. Were they tainted? Did he need to hunt each of them down? Others were clearly shocked, ignorant of their part in the manifestation. He stepped quickly to the altar. The Aquila shone with a coating of ice.
"Nobody leave!" he bellowed, drawing back his hood. "I am Custodian Amon Tauromachian, and by the authority of the Emperor, you are all under arrest."
None of the remaining congregation tried to leave, awestruck by the presence of the custodian revealed in their midst. Amon struck the Aquila with the pommel of the gladius, knocking it from the altar, before striding back to the corpse. It had all but melted into a puddle, like an oil slick in the dust and grime. Even as he activated his vox to call for assistance, his thoughts turned to his companion in the investigation. Keeler would not be able to argue away this event quite so easily. Chapter 23. The Keeler Issue. Kroger's Plan. Phosphex. Exultant Wall Zone. 12 days since assault.
"How could you possibly not see the threat posed by this cult?"
Amon rarely raised his voice outside of battle, but his words rang back to him from the vaulted roof of the hall, the last word echoing menacingly. Keeler opened her mouth to answer, but was quieted by the raised hand of Malkador.
"It is to that very point that this debate is turned, Custodian," said the regent.
They moved in brisk procession along an inner passage of the ultimate wall. Dawn's decree was that they speak only as he moved between other engagements that required his attention. The thunder of impacts and the counterfire of the towers was a constant vibration in the walls and floor. The clank of magazine hoists pulling up shells to the macro cannons, and the tramp of booted feet echoed from side corridors and bastion chambers. Footfalls ahead betrayed the presence of 4 Imperial Fist squads, clearing the path to the Praetorian's destination, a moving cordon of Templars from Sigismund's command. Their presence ensured the impromptu conclave went unheard. As well as Malkador and Dawn, the gathering included First Captain Sigismund and Constantin Valdor. These giants were forced to pace slowly so that Malkador could keep up, his staff tapping on the bare ferrocrete floor. Keeler was accompanied by Kirill Sinderman, who now spoke for the first time.
To accept that is to concede that Lady Keeler herself poses a threat to the Emperor, said the former iterator.
He smoothed a crease in his robes with precise, delicate hands.
And my own beliefs, though they are of substantially less importance at this juncture. Captain General, I know what occurred in the hospital, said Amon. Coupled with the evidence from the quarantine barracks, it is obvious that there is a link between the rites of the Lectitio Divinitatis and demonic activity.
And what do you propose? Said Malkador.
He cleared his throat of the dust that drifted through the beams of lumen light.
I am not certain a purge of the theists will be productive, even if possible. The siege is too finely poised to risk immense resentment among a significant swathe of our soldiers.
This is not a discussion of prosecuting a law, but of guaranteeing the sanctuary of the Imperial Palace, said Valdor.
His armor hummed as he turned to look at the regent.
The battle rages on many levels. You know this.
I cannot spare any warriors,
Dorne said bluntly. He looked aggravated at being waylaid outside of the Strategium, but his presence was essential. Amon had hoped the Praetorian would be a staunch ally, but he apparently needed some further persuasion.
I cannot tell you how the spirit war fares, but the physical conflict stands upon the balance. The enemy are in control of half the base levels of the Lionsgate spaceport, and nearly a similar amount of territory in the upper spire. A force of unknown size is targeting objectives in Sky City, but Commander Ran cannot spare the firepower to eradicate them without weakening the defense of the transport bridges. I have drawn together a reinforcement strike that Captain Sigismund will lead within the hour, but that leaves me with no reserves. All of the legions are stretched thin.
Given your recent encounter with the demon Samus aboard the Phalanx, let us recall that timely reminder of the perils posed by the Neverborn, said Amon,
moving his gaze to Keeler.
Let us not also overlook that incident's connection to you, through the figure of Mercedes Oliton.
I know little of what happened, replied Keeler,
looking from Amon to Malkador.
In any event, Mercedes and I parted company long ago.
I hear accusations, but no solid proposals,
Malkador said again, shaking his head.
Rogel is correct. We cannot spare warriors from the walls to patrol the inner palace. Such a diversion may be the only intent of these manifestations.
We must trust in the Emperor to protect us, said Keeler. I witnessed his power, I swear. It is by his will that the Neverborn are kept at bay. The worship of the Lectitio Divinitatis will only strengthen that power.
That is true, to a point, conceded Malkador. It is the telethesic ward that shields us from demonic intrusion. The Emperor is under constant assault. Perhaps it is not surprising that the odd leak is now occurring.
Is the Emperor in danger?
Demanded Valdor.
What of the security of the Imperial dungeon?
The Emperor is always in danger, Constantine. It is the nature of being the adversary of the four powers to live with their enmity.
But is he physically threatened by this?
I think not.
What of the Silent Sisterhood?
Asked Keeler.
Should they not have a representative here?
The Sisters of Silence are as stretched by these attacks as all of our other forces, Dorne told her. Having been forced from their lunar facilities, they lack some of the support they would normally have to conduct widespread anti-psyker actions. They guard the walls against sorcery, even as the Emperor guards terror against the demonic.
Perhaps it is simply the psychic that we should investigate,
suggested Valdor, looking meaningfully at Keeler.
You profess powers that can only be described as coming from the warp.
From the Emperor, she said, folding her arms. Not from the enemy.
A distinction only you seem to be able to make, said Amon.
You ignore several pertinent facts,
argued Sinderman, stepping protectively next to Keeler.
Firstly, I myself have witnessed rites of abjuration using the holy text.
The supposed banishing of a demon aboard the vengeful spirit?
Malkador scratched his chin.
Was not that conjuration precipitated by your own hand?
In error,
Sinderman said hastily.
Through a cursed book,
Regardless, it was the power of the Emperor that allowed Lady Keeler to dispel the Neverborn.
I felt real power with the Lightbearers, said Keeler. Power we could harness. Why should the Emperor protect us at his expense without us giving back? Our prayers can be used as weapons against the unholy, just as surely as bolts and lasblasts are the foes of mortals.
Let us put that aside for a moment, lest we are sidetracked, Malkador said quickly.
He looked at Sindarin.
You said, firstly, indicating you have other reasons why we should not suspect Keeler in this matter.
The first apparition took place when she was in confinement, the second when she was elsewhere. The only manifestation we have when Lady Keeler was actually present seems to be entirely benign.
Is such a thing possible?
Asked Sigismund, breaking his silence. The Templar followed a little apart from the group, and Amon had almost forgotten him.
Can it be possible to channel the essence of the Emperor in such a way?
Amon noticed Dorne's deep frown, as though vexed at the first captain's contribution.
We will not be indulging in superstitious speculation, the Primarch growled.
Is it superstition, when one has evidence of the supernatural?
Said Sindarin, receiving a glare of admonishment from the towering commander. He absorbed the brunt of Dorne's displeasure with a visible flinch. Even his long experience of the Primarch's no surety against the intimidating presence of the Emperor's gene-sons. He continued in more subdued fashion.
If the power of the Neverborn can be channeled by sorcery, cannot a person of faith act as focus for the Emperor's might?
I do not know if this is a discussion of theology or metaphysics, but neither is useful for our purpose,
Valdor said, cutting off a reply from Malkador.
What is to be done about these cults? I accept the argument that for the time being a harmless worship of the Emperor may be good for morale, and perhaps keeps minds looking for a greater power from wandering down paths left unexplored.
Harmless, said Amon. Twice we have seen what these ceremonies can do, breaching the ward that protects Terra.
I did not say it was harmless, only that if it is so, it may have a use,
Valdor told his subordinate. He swung his gaze down to Keeler.
There are hundreds of groups practicing your faith around the Imperial Palace?
At least, she replied, for longer than the siege has been in place.
So it seems to me there is more connection to the efforts of the Death Guard than the cults themselves.
Valdor stopped, then the group halted with him at the junction of the main corridor and a side passage that led back towards the inner palace region.
The quarantine zone and the hospital are the common denominator, more than the cult. Amon, concentrate your efforts on other such pits of misery, for any activity by the Lectitio Divinitatis in such places brings greater risk of corruption.
What of the Lightbearers?
Asked Amon.
Keeler will continue to attend and monitor their meetings, said Malkador.
I will report anything untoward as soon as it occurs, Keeler said.
Amon shook his head.
I find that little assurance, given the bar that has been set to judge what is untoward.
We shall need to trust each other a while longer,
Malkador intervened, stepping between the custodian and Keeler. His unwavering gaze met Amon's.
Will you take my assurance?
Amon hesitated. There was only one being that he fully trusted, but in placing his trust in the Emperor, he had to submit to his master's decision to appoint Malkador as his regent, with the full authority that entailed. He glanced to Valdor, then received a subtle nod in reply.
Very well, Lord Regent.
Amon lifted a fist to his breastplate.
I will investigate the plague aspect of the attack, and leave the Lightbearers to your appointee.
My officers can provide you with data on field hospitals, plague zones, Death Guard assaults.
Dorne gestured along the side passage.
I will signal Bab Bastion to be ready to respond to your requests immediately.
Our thanks, Lord Praetorian, said Valdor.
I shall return to the Sanctum Imperialis with you, said Malkador,
stepping after the two custodians.
I am sure Lord Dorne would prefer to have no more distractions from his duties at the Wall.
Lionsgate Spaceport, Mesifex Mantle Zone, 12 days since assault. Workshops that had once resounded to the beat of hammers and hiss of forges now rang with the crack of bolters and snarl of plasma. Maintenance lines became bulwarks held by the Imperial fists, their bright armour smeared with grease and soot, the flare of bolts bright pinpricks in the gloom of the massive halls. Las cannon beams and detonating missiles cast shadows of tractor skeletons and hauler carcasses. The Sons of Horus pushed from one cavernous workshop to the next, thrusting deep into the territory reclaimed by the counteroffensive. At their head, Abaddon and his Justerin formed the point of the spear, as they had been in so many battles before. The first captain urged his warriors on by example, plunging into each fresh firefight without relent. Bolter, sword, and fist took their toll of the enemy, while at his side the sorceries of Laak split apart their armour and bewitched their weapons. Combi bolters blazing, the Terminators followed, clearing aside any that survived the wrath of their leader. The bulk of an auto-lathe offered a few seconds' respite, giving Abaddon opportunity to assess the broader situation. Issuing orders to send a company to the upper levels of the refitting houses, he checked the sensorium of his warplate. More enemies were arriving from a travel duct that ran along the far side of the installation, the heat plumes of 5 vehicles approaching at speed.
"Why do you pause now?"
asked Laak, his blade slaves picking through the fallen enemy, plunging sword limbs into each.
"You have the momentum!"
Abaddon regarded him for several seconds, undecided whether he would respond or not. It was no business of the sorcerer what he intended. He signalled for Hawk to bring the Auspex.